David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 471. I'm your host, Steve Raker, along with my longtime podcasting co-conspirator, Andrew the L.A. Rabbit.
Hey, Super Steve, it feels like it was just a few years ago you invited me on to talk Captain America in a broiling hot summer. And here it is, broiling hot summer, but no more Captain America.
The third head of the Living Tribunal here, Kevin, is off doing a con, being the con man that he is. Marvel Noise is an independent, Marvel-centric podcast proudly sponsored by nobody. Our scope is anything Marvel-related we feel like making noise about. Comics, television, movies, toys, games, you name it. And in the
anything at all, Steve, now that we run the show. We can do whatever we want.
That's what I was about to say. We're operating here in the spirit of Derek Howard's Deliberate Noise Network. We forge on in his name, and now we control the horizontal and the vertical, and we're still fine getting our legs around here.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Patience is appreciated, everybody. I think we're looking pretty good, but I know it was a little rocky, but the website and iTunes seem to be posting, so... fingers crossed.
There's still some scaffolding up. We're living out of boxes, but we'll get there.
I blame the assistant editor, Steve.
You can find, download, and listen to episodes new and old over on marvelnoise.com. And we invite you to check out our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, where we talk about the indie books that we dig. All right, we've assembled here in the comic book bunker tonight for a Bronze Age binge that's near and dear to my heart. It's the first 12 issues of The Micronauts from 1978 and 9.
Yeah, Steve, you tempted me. It's so funny. So, as a longtime listener, I love these Epic editions. So they had them all out in Epic, so I bought them all. And then I remembered that I had... 95% of the series and floppies, but it's good because, you know, I'm missing a few. I just never slotted the whole. So it was, and these Epic editions are so nice and it's good to have it. And I don't know what was going on in still only 35 cents era, but some of the print is a little bit, it didn't look like these were, I mean, I love floppies, but the Epic in this case is worth the investment over trying to, because I did bust them out, was going through, and yeah, it looks nice in the Epic form.
The Micronauts were among the licensed properties that Marvel explored after with the success of like Star Wars in the late 70s there, along with Shogun Warriors and Godzilla and ROM, and they've been long out of print until a few years ago, where along with ROM and Godzilla, still waiting for Shogun Warriors, they've managed to recollect this series in the Epic collections, like you said, the softcover ones or hardcover omnibuses.
Go with the Epic editions, folks. I can't sing their praises enough. They're a good amount of issues. They're readable. Some of those omnibuses, I just find they're kind of bulky and hard to manipulate. Plus, they slide a few extras in the Epics. Just a great, great format, and they kind of slot them however they come out. So, you know, I'm hoping they stick with this one.
I was already reading most of Marvel's books by the time that the Micronauts came out. And in the months beforehand, there was a pretty aggressive ad campaign of like third page landscape house ads. They came from inner space and showing different images that really piqued my curiosity as a 7 and 8 year old at the time. In the mid 1970s, Mego, the maker of the superhero and Star Trek and Planet of the Apes dolls and Universal Monsters too, right? In the 70s,
they had Remco had some of those too, Steve.
Oh yeah, they were just Mego sized, right? Mego got the license for these Japanese toys with interchangeable parts that were there known as Micro Man. And they revamped them into the Micronauts. And the Micronauts figures, vehicles, and playsets were in toy shops from 1976, when I was a six-year-old, to 1980.
Yeah, it was a crazy... I thought I'd give a quick divertissement into the world of toys, because we do a lot of the coverage one. And it was... It's pretty crazy how... Well, first of all, I have to acknowledge that when Kenner dropped Star Wars, it cleared the map in a way that I think people from skipping... If you weren't familiar with this stuff before then, it's understandable why you would forget. Like, it just was this juggernaut that existed. But going way back, the big dog used to be the Louis Marx company. Like, in the 50s, they were the toy company. They were the largest. A lot of production over here. Some licensed stuff, but a lot of, like, big play sets and everything. You always had Mattel. They dropped Barbie in the 60s that took off, obviously, and then later Hot Wheels. And also, obviously, Hasbro with Mr. Potato Head. And then the big G.I. Joe. But I think... It's understandable if you forgot from the 70s, I would say a company that you and I both know, Steve, is Ideal. Earlier than that, they released the first kind of boys action doll with interchangeable outfits. But the real reason they were popping in the 70s is they had the Evel Knievel stunt bike, which anyone that's looked at the comics has seen the ad on the back page, but that thing had to be like the number one toy of the 70s for anybody that had it. But the other huge company, as you mentioned, was Mego. Now, Mego and Marx both went away in the early 80s, but for the 70s, as you said, all those licenses they had, plus Takara was the Japanese company that put out Microman, and they had a relationship. They were connected to Hasbro because the original big G.I. Joes, that's where the Cyborg Henshin character came from, which then when, as everyone knows in the 70s, oil and plastics got expensive, what happens to your toys? They get a lot smaller. So I know you've talked about that with Kevin and some of the Marvel toys, actually, in more recent decades, how they had to, you know, once the prices get up, they just want to stop putting those bits in. And that's where the famous O-ring design, which you would then see later Hasbro uses in G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero. So just fascinating, the sort of interconnected world. But always been curious about Takara, always been fascinated, particularly a character we're going to talk about, Baron Karza, or Kotetsu Jig. So basically they took a Steel Jig, a character was in a 1975 anime over there. I love watching that stuff. I never saw it as a kid, but I've watched it looking up all this stuff. And it's the same body, but he's super colorful. And all Mego did was give him a new head, a bucket head, and paint him black. You know, nothing to do with Star Wars, right, Steve?
Right.
Got him black. But Baron Karza is a larger magnetic toy. And that thing, I never had it, but fascinated the heck out of me. Magnetic toy, Steve. The bits move around and everything.
It was awesome. I always
felt like, what happened with that? Don't we have more of that?
His joints were big metal ball bearings that would fit into the magnetic concave scooped out joint housings at his hips, pelvis, and his shoulders. So the ball served as a joint connector, but also had 360 degree and, you know, abduction and adduction. It had all internal rotation, extra. You could move it every which way. So you had all of a sudden, you had this really movable. We used to put those bear cars in all kinds of crazy positions with his legs twisted up and out and everything. You know, the ways that Barbies wouldn't bend or they would break, you know, that kind of a thing. And the fact that they came out with the white version, the Force Commander, that was like the good guy versus the bad guy, you could pull off the white guy's arm and put it on the black bot. You could mix them all up and make them all like in-betweener guys and stuff. And we did all that. Plus, they had the Centaur horse bodies that you can
Yes.
connect them on and switch
Those
them all
look so
around.
good.
And oh my, just those two toys alone would have been memorable chunk of my action figure playtime as a single digit kid in my memories. But there were all of the little figures too, and all of their weaponry and all of their metal parts and their vehicles and their play sets. I had a lot of this stuff. I was r really into the Micronauts.
Two words, Steve, that I will always love Japan for are the rocket fists and like launching body parts and everything. That is the best with the Shoguns and all this. Yeah, anyways, just wanted to give Mego. I mean, I know they came back, but they had all these pop culture licenses, not just superheroes and Planet Apes and Star Trek, but like Chips and Cher and like weird. Like it was a weird
The
collection of Love Boat. They did a Love Boat toy.
Micronaut, yeah, I got Isaac. We saw him in the Toys R Us. I'm like, I gotta have an Isaac. We just like had him like walk into like scenes with all the other guys, all the like Star Wars guys, and all of a sudden Isaac's there. You had to do that. When the toys ended in 1980, I was 10 years old, and that's also the year that I had my house fire that destroyed all my
Wow.
toys. So when I in the year that followed, when I was replacing toys that I wanted to replace, these weren't even an option anymore. So it
No,
was
yeah,
funny,
what?
but it was funny that they were recognizable though, Andrew, in the soot and sludge of all the stuff in my side yard, the day after the fire, smoldering piles of stuff as we're like using shovels to move stuff around and try to list things that we could identify. I could totally identify the Micronauts because all their plastic parts were melted into each other, but their metal parts remained.
And the other thing I want to shout out them is I personally did not. I had a bunch of G1 Transformers, another imported Japanese toy, but I thought they were kind of fragile and usually one mode wasn't very good. And I kind of turned on the toys because they weren't good. But those Micronauts, they were, like you say, you could play with them. They look good. They weren't just little models that you
The
could do
only
stuff with them.
problem was their hand. The hands of the smaller guys, they had a thumb that was just like a little hair trigger that you could, it would bend in when you tried to put the gun in his hand. And like I had so many thumbs that were bent in that, yeah, like you'd use a toothpick to try to push it back out. Oh, pretty funny. But
Hasbro used cheap plastic and the thumbs would just break right off for their first generation G.I. Joe. I mean, they got better plastic, but
Oh yeah,
that
or I
first
remember
wave, most
so
of
many.
them are busted thumbs.
That was after this era though.
Yeah.
So
Yeah, that was the 80s.
the toys were first, and
Yes.
Marvel writer Bill Mantlo's son for Christmas in 1977 gets some of them, and Bill's like, these are pretty cool designs, but they're and their names are suggestive of, some kind of something more, but there's no backstory. There's nothing, no purpose. They're just cool looking figures. So Manlow starts asking himself the question, what would these guys be up? Where do they come from? What are they, that guy, who's the good guys? Who's the bad guys? So Mantler goes to Jim Shooter, who at the time the company was reaching out looking for licensed properties as the boys on the board up top, Galton and those guys were wanting. That's why Marvel added all these licensed properties at the time. So Shooter, within the week, gets the publishing license for the Micronauts. So it wasn't even something that Mego was looking for. Any they were, Marvel contacts them. Hey, look, we got ideas. We got this. We'll do this. Sign here. Boom. And Bill Mantlo, his pedigree when this started, 78, he had written like the Sons of the Tiger, White Tiger backups, and the Deadly Hands of Kung Fu magazine. He had written a bunch of fill-ins across the Marvel Universe titles to be able to use if they had publishing delays and getting new issues out, that they could, put in the fill-in issue. And he had written the 75 Champions book. So he'd only done a few things. Michael Golden, the penciler of these 12 issues that we're covering here, had was really fresh. He had done some Batman family stories over at DC and Mr. Miracle and the Demon just the year before in 77, and was convinced to come over to design these characters with Bob Hall and be the penciler on this book. The inker was Joe Rubinstein, who was also a newbie, so to speak. The title ran from 79 to 84, 59 issues and two annuals. And around 18, issue 18, was one of Marvel's first three titles to go direct market only, along with Kazar the Savage and Moon Knight. And then they had a volume two, The New Voyages, that ran 20 issues from 84 to 86 with a different writer, with Peter B. Gillis. And in between in 84, they had an X-Men Micronauts four-issue limited series that, if Marvel has its way, will never be mentioned again. It had a couple of salacious scenes in it that, maybe looking back, weren't the best choice when Professor X does like a mind rape on someone who's underage.
It was, as you say, the marketing, I think, was really the character. I mean, even if you didn't know the toys, the design of the toys is very eye-catching. Plus, Marvel always adds great supporting characters, and their designs are going to be fun. So it was really was all those posters and promos and everything really do kind of stick in your head. Plus, we're in the sci-fi era, and everybody's excited for sci-fi properties. So yeah, I was all in all primed for this. I don't remember when I jumped in, I'll be honest, but I do remember reading it. But I haven't revisited these issues since, I don't know, the 70s or
Awesome.
whatever. So it was fun to go back and just immerse yourself, because so much of it I had forgotten, and also some of it just kind of slotted into. That's how Marvel does these things. But like I said, great character designs. And I'm going to flip between, I'm probably going to call him Acro Year or a
Sure.
Croyer, or go back and forth. But I reading, you just develop a pronunciation, whether it's right or not.
Mantlo added the character, added the girl, added Marionette to the cast, but otherwise repurposed figures and toys as was their directive. You got to use the vehicles, you got to use the toys. And then there was one funny directive also that really changed the course of the book after 1980, once the toys stopped being made. And that then they could break free of this directive, which was you need to keep reminding everybody of their scale, that they're small, which forced them to keep going back to Earth instead of just exploring the microverse, which is kind of where the book went, around issue 25 or so on.
And it has its strengths there, but part of this is they're casting about, figuring out where this, I mean, while they got ideas, you still need to find your pace or whatever, and they do find their space. I don't know. It was there are a lot of things I like about these first few issues that I had forgotten about, so excited. It was fun getting back into them and being like, oh, that's right, I forgot about that, and I forgot about that. And Golden's kind of a real fun, sometimes serious, but mostly cartoony art really plays well in this, especially when they go back to Earth and they're playing stuff more for humor.
The
And then, of course, I obviously, we're not covering it this time, but obviously Annual One was big for me because it's
yeah,
Steve Ditko
two
return,
also.
back at Marvel.
Ditko did both the annuals.
And his he when you gave him like a toy property or something, he got it.
Yep,
He could make them
it's
look
true.
like toys in a way that was really great. He was always good with that stuff.
The first issue hit the stands in September of 78, with a January 1979 cover date. But the cover is a Dave Cockrum, Alan Milgram cover, with Cockrum basically doing his giant size X-Men cover composition here, but with Karza in the back instead of it being the old team.
Karza, a bit, so much of a great design, but yeah, I can see people saying the Darth Vader thing. From the head up, it's not the most unique, but it looks so good in profile.
The basic idea of the series is that Commander Ran returns from a Buck Rogers scenario.
I was just going to mention, they love the, we have to have a guy out of time and out of place kind of thing.
Yeah, his Buck Rogers scenario, where he was on a deep space mission, and during his 1,000-year absence, Baron Karza rose to power using his brutal body banks to rule Homeworld. And Homeworld is like a molecule on a DNA chain with these interconnected biome nodes. And Karza basically took control by using the poor people as fodder to provide parts for his body banks that keep the rich and powerful people youthful and alive, and in turn, they keep him in power.
I had appreciated a toy children's product where the bad guy was actually useful, and you could see why. So many of these, you're just like, oh, he's running it and he's evil and everyone's afraid of him or whatever, but I was like, hey, this actually makes sense. Cars is actually providing a great service if you're rich and want to live forever. You could totally see why people would agree, because sometimes you get some of these villains and you're like, why is any, it's just fear is the only motivation. But I thought it was subtle that they have a real reason why people would be invested in his success. And he's also not cowardly like some other bad guys who, when really push comes to shove, were kind of afraid. I thought they made some nice choices with Karza, but the Buck Rogers Star Wars looms large because they do have the sassy robot thing, which you just had to have as part of your science fiction. But that goes back to like Danger Will Robinson and all that stuff. People like a sassy robot.
So Commander Ran gets captured and he meets a Kroyer and Bug in captivity, and they escape and rescue one of the remaining royal family members of Homeworld, Princess Mari, Marionette, and they flee Homeworld in Ran's spacecraft, aided by the mysterious time traveler. And Princess,
and she has a sassy robot too. Make sure everybody's got a sassy robot going on.
And Princess Mary has a brother who, Prince Argon, who is left behind, and he gets captured and brought to the body banks where he's going to get mutilated.
Yeah, reminiscent of recent, for indie comic book noise listeners, reminiscent of the recent Transformers storyline where you have one group fighting and then another group back on the home world who are leading the resistance. In this case, it's going to be Argon.
Issue 2 has the awesome lawnmower cover with the push mower coming at the Micronauts on Earth, and there are, you know, grasses flying everywhere, and they're about to get caught up in it. And it's funny because it's a push mower on the cover, but it's a power mower inside.
We had the push mower. My brother, I think, still used it.
Got to keep it sharp, otherwise you're just pushing.
Yeah, but good exercise if you need it.
So the Micronauts escape from Homeworld, warps them to Earth, where they're tiny. Here you go. Here you get the size differential stuff thrown at you. They meet Steve Coffin, who's an adolescent, and they're chased by a squadron of ships, and he's like helping fight them off by like swinging his rake at them and stuff. It's pretty,
yeah,
pretty fun.
The Gooder Kroyer, basically his people were tricked into following Karza. So his half-brother or step-brother, whatever the connection is running them, but he's afraid he has to destroy the real leader so they don't get put back against to fight. Because they have to explain why this noble race of fighters is, you know, siding with the bad guy. And I thought that was smart, too. You know, little brother against brother, some classic sci-fi tropes.
A Kroyer's brother, Prince Shaitan, the galactic cruiser that he chases after them in, I had one of those as a kid, and it was really cool because it was a massive ship, but it broke up into 5 mini ships. And this is years before Voltron was on TV that we got that whole breaking apart kind of, it was pretty cool thing.
Modular toys are cool, Steve.
Steve's father, Ray, comes home and gets brought up to a speed and is pretty accepting of what's happening because this you know, there's bodies and there's damage in the yard and stuff. So, you know, they've got proof.
Yeah, it's hard to fake explosions and everything. And it is nice that even though they're tiny, I mean, and so they can be hurt, but you know, their laser guns and stuff will hurt you too.
In issues 4 and 5, Ray and Steve Collins bring the remains of some of Carza's soldiers and one of the spaceships to one of Ray's contemporaries who works at NASA. But this professor guy, he already knows about the Microverse. In fact, he built his own Prometheus Pit portal to it and turned himself into a cyborg. He's mad, I tell you. Mad!
The only part I didn't like was they acronym the lab so it spells hell, which really seems a little over the top, but it's comics.
Ray Coffin ends up saving his son from being thrown into the pit by tackling the scientist and tumbling into the portal with him. Another thing I should mention is that in a bunch of these issues, there's back matter in the floppies. The
Oh
first
and
issue
in
has
the
these,
and in the epic too.
and in the omnibuses for that matter, but in they have these Meet the Micronauts bios in the back of issue number one, and there are pinups of Time Traveler and Baron Karza in issues 2 and 3, and in four there's a cross section of the Endeavor ship. I love when they do cross sections of the ships and the headquarters.
And the planet, yeah, it's so crazy. They really, what the Earth stuff can be a little fun and goofy, but they really built out a whole empire and different worlds and different, there's the Acroyer world and wherever Bug's from and all these different locations and politics and everything.
See, I would have thought that Kevin would have really enjoyed these. He wasn't too hot on reading these issues, and fair enough, they're of a different time. They're of my time, and but you know, he likes cross sections. He would have liked the cross section of the ship.
Oh, for sure. I think you would have liked, I would have thought the crazy character designs might have got him too, because I think he likes kind of a wacky design.
For sure. Issue 6 has a really great, one of my favorite Michael Golden covers, where you're looking past Marionette, who's in the foreground, so she can be big. And she's shooting through the windshield of a police car with the astonished driver looking up at her, so he's also looking up at us. It's a great, great cover. The Micronauts in this issue help Steve Coffin escape from that secret NASA Project Hell facility there.
Project Hell. It kills me every time.
And meanwhile, Karza is alerted to the fact that Ray and Dr. Prometheus are falling into the Microverse at full size.
Yeah, he's his whole fear is that in the 1,000-year travel Buck Rogers went, he may have gathered information that can defeat him because he's pretty secure. So that's what kind of his return to Micronaut world triggered everything off, and that's what Karza, to the extent he's concerned about something, that's what he's trying to get at. Like, what secrets did he learn that could end up defeating me? Because we're going to see a character we've discussed before coming up, the Captain Universe Enigma Force and all that stuff
Yeah.
coming out, so.
Well, to start that sequence, Ray gets teleported away from Prometheus and is confronted by the Time Traveler in some sort of null space. And Prince Aragorn, the brother of Marionette, has been turned into a centaur by
Yes.
Karza's scientist, and he and a female rebel lieutenant, Slug, tough name. Must have been tough on the schoolyard. They escape Karza's dungeons.
Well, you need the there's the white horse toy, Steve.
Yeah,
So we need to.
I'm here. I'm feeling these. Those were my favorite. And Kurt Busiek writes one of the letters on the letters page in this issue. Kind of cool. Issue 7 has the iconic Man-Thing cover, where the Micronauts and Steve hide away in an Everglades cabin, and Steve's strong emotions about losing his dad draws the man thing.
Actually, I grew up in the era of you need trouble, you throw Spider-Man in your comic. And then it became Wolverine and Punisher and Venom. It's funny to think like we need to boost sales. Ooh, we got the man thing. Yeah, the kids love it. But the cover is great because they're like little toys to him. So that part is great, which is funny. Yeah, we don't want to use Spider-Man because they used him in Transformers early on too.
No, it's just funny. Years later.
You need to get some sales, man. Drop one of your top guys in the book. But yeah, great cover.
This is like 6 or 7 years before Transformers. Karza realizes that he can use the Prometheus Pit. That it's like a two-way equation. He can explore Earth at full size if he goes through the pit. Reverse. So in issue 8, he emerges from the pit and attacks Cape Canaveral and NASA. While in the Microverse, on Homeworld, the Shadow Priests that operate around Karza explain to Prince Aragorn and the Rebel Slug that they oppose Karza in secret, even though they're appearing to advise him, and that their order was started by the Time Travelers.
Yeah, they don't really... He doesn't like them, and they don't like him. I always like that was... But this one, Bob McLeod adding, is kind of Ditko-feely, too. Very reminds me of the Doctor Strange fighting Eternity type, because lots of crazy power beams and weird backgrounds and everything. This one is a little bit getting away from kind of the cartoony, more realistic base. I mean, I like that too, but I really like Karza's firing all his things. And then when he squares up against Captain Universe and everything, just really fun looking stuff.
Yeah, this is the issue that Captain Universe gets introduced. Time Traveler turns Ray Collins into a defender by saturating him with the Enigma Force. Then he can protect Earth and pops out of the Prometheus pit and fights Karza, like, and we get like a mid-issue splash page of them fighting. It's really cool.
And this is before he could be the hero that could be you, Steve. You could be Captain Universe if you played your cards right.
Well, that's just it, because at the end of the issue, they take the Enigma Force back from Ray, and then he's never Captain Universe again. So that concept existed to be used elsewhere, which it has been for good and bad.
I remember Spider-Man getting the thing one time. Yeah, Captain, it just was a... I like how they turned it into such a gimmick. Like, it's this fun idea, and then it became like the hero that could be you type of thing.
I like those Ditko issues of Marvel Spotlight. I think it was Spotlight that had Captain Universe. There was like three of them that Ditko drew. The teacher and the... I forget the other guys, but...
Yeah, but this one, gave me those Ditko vibes I love so much with the crazy backgrounds and energies and all that. Yeah, well, strong recommend just remember it's going to feel a little bit different than some of the other issues.
While the battle is going on between Captain Universe and Baron Karza, the Micronauts realize they can access the Prometheus pit without Karza taking them out, and the Endeavor swoops down and they escape back to Homeworld, back to the Microverse, which then forces Karza to retreat from his battle with Captain Universe, which isn't going anywhere anyway, because he's afraid that if they go back to the Microverse, they could cut off the portal from the other end.
Yeah, no one wants to be stuck in Florida, Steve.
Yeah. Issues 9 and 10, and I love the cover of issue 9. With the team centered in color, surrounded by the Acroyers, all shaded in blue. It's very, like, Jim Starlin-esque of a design, you know?
Particularly when they take their helmets off, and their heads always remind me of, like, a Starlin-type, skull-head-type creature.
In these issues, Acroyer is welcomed back onto his planet Spartak. His bad brother, Shaitan, is imprisoned. And Karza returns to his army and leads their space fleet to Spartak to assault them from the air. You don't want to fight Acroyers in melee or hand-to-hand combat. They're superior, so they can just bomb them from the air. And we get some glimpses of Acroyers' culture and their system of government, and we meet his beloved and everything, and we also get to see Acroyer take his helmet off, and also his beloved, which, yuck, right?
Also, like the meanwhile, because all his forces are engaged, Force Commander gets to launch a rebellion on the homeworld with a great splash page that does remind me out of like the Star Wars comics of the time, like blasters firing, and he's in centaur mode with the armor on, and there's some good splashes in this these first 12.
And they know where to attack too. They are going to the body banks, and they're going to burn them down.
Yeah, well, that's his leverage to keep power is them body banks.
Acroyer does this funky King of the Acroyers ritual thing to become one with his planet, which is somewhat sentient, and release its power on their behalf. Meanwhile, Commander Ran and Marionette confront Baron Karza aboard his flagship, and that doesn't really go well for them.
No, Karza's a bad dude. He is super powerful, but the world mind, I always do like the ego, the living planet, and all that type of gimmick. Yeah. Like, it's a fun, again, kind of had that Starlin, Marvel, cosmic-y feel going to it for me.
The rebels burning down the body banks there on Homeworld come to Karza's attention. And he's like, I'm heading back there. You guys keep this assault up on the Acroyers. And as soon as Karza leaves, the Acroyers basically get the upper hand between Acroyer himself having the power of the world mind, and the planet starts throwing rocks at them. And and they're able to drive Karza's forces away without Karza there to lead them.
The planet's alive. It's like those old Twilight Zones or whatever, or EC comics, and they land and the planet's trying to kill them type of thing. Yeah, that's what the world mind, and his brother's just laying into him about what a loser he is and all this other stuff. It's a fun, you know, that kind of, they always have that, you know, the Prince John or whatever character who's just going to be a craven dude, just letting you have it.
And now, somehow, as a 9-year-old back in 1979, I missed issue 11 at the newsstand.
Whoa, that's a key issue, Steve.
Although by then, I actually might have been going to Fanico, my first LCS. But I got the next issue. And it wasn't for a few months before I was able to get this one as a back issue. And even seeing this cover now to this day, it seems like exotic and special to me because it like wasn't the one that I picked up off the stands. It was like I had to freaking look for that one and find it. And then I found it and was like, oh, yes, that's what I wanted. The end, because the storyline doesn't finish. Golden stops after 12. You'd think 1 year monthly issues. Issue 12 would be the one that the war would be won in. No, it's in issue 11 that everything goes down.
Lots of loving shots of Karza, too. You really get, like, the full armor and the little studs on his chest and everything. Yeah, so shocking. I had forgotten, like, wow, they do in Darth Vader pretty quickly in this thing, you know?
And that cover with the deep red background, too. It just seems, like I said, like exotic to me. It's funny. I love the splash page columns on either side with the roll call heads too. And as you're looking down them and looking at all the characters, it ends with Slug and Bug. I like that too. Obviously Slug. Intentional. So Force Commander, this issue, fights Baron Karza, centaur to centaur. And Andrew, I can still hear the magnetic click of putting those arms on it, or putting the body torso onto the centaur's body. So cool.
And yeah, and the classic 80s trick and late 70s, 80s trick of like just crazy backgrounds with very little detail in it that just give you the sense of crackling energy.
Karza defeats Force Commander, and then the Shadow Priests reveal themselves to be the Time Travelers, wielding the awesome power of the Enigma Force, each a part of Commander Rand's consciousness from his thousand-year quest that he, like, lost along the way, and they're all coming back to him now. He gets all powered up, Commander Rand does, and bests Karza. sending him down into his own Prometheus pit.
Well, the real treasure was the Enigma Force we found on the way, Steve.
And then the Encroyers show up and help the Rebels just mop up Kars' remaining forces.
And then he's left as a broken toy at the end.
It's true. Dude, I totally posed my Kars in pieces exactly like that. Just to recreate that panel. Issue 12 hit the stands in November of 1979 with a really killer Michael Golden Acroyer cover. It's Gil Kane-esque when you look at it.
Yes, and the designs are fun because the helmet obscures all facial detail because they were little toys, remember? So
yep.
That saved on some of the sculpting, but it looks pretty cool.
With the war over now, the Micronauts are like licking their wounds, and Force Commander is going to help lead Homeworld. Acroyer, though, he feels compelled to return home and lead his world, Spartak. And there he's got to pass judgment on what the fate of his traitorous brother is going to be. And his brother, he keeps playing the I'm an albino card, like, rather than taking any responsibility for any of the stuff that he did, he's like, oh, you're just because I'm an albino. It's like, no, it's not. It's because you, like, you know, sent our whole culture down up the river. Anyway, we get what I thought was a really cool history of the Acroyers wandering in their space arc and coming upon Spartak. They're looking for a home world. Spartak's like, he's like, I don't have much to offer you. I'm a pretty harsh environment, but you can have me. And they decide to just do the hard thing and live there. Really cool way to find your home world.
Yeah. I thought it was a fun kind of look at the warrior hardcore people that were always so popular in media, as it were.
And it's a glimpse into what this title could be. We've only seen Homeworld and Spartak. There's so much of this microverse to explore, you know, and that's really where the title will end up going. And of course, as part of this trial of the brother, Acroyer's brother, you know, challenges him to the ancient tribal right duel for power thing. So we get 5 pages of Acroyer and his brother fighting in this foreign environment before Acroyer runs his brother through.
Well, you know, and the evil brother's got to do every slimy trick and stuff like that.
Yep.
So as you do.
Issue 12 was Michael Golden's last issue on the series, even though he's remembered so fondly for it. And although he sticks around for covers for a while. I mean, Golden did great covers across Marvel's line of books at this time after he stopped the monthly grind. Some really nice, I mean, from Rom to She-Hulk to Doctor Strange to the Hulk. Great cover artist Golden was.
Yeah. You see him at shows still. He usually has a pretty big booth and selling prints and everything.
And replacing Golden on the title is Howard Chaykin doing layouts with Al Milgram finishes. Pat Broderick. Steve Ditko on the 2 annuals.
Oh, Steve, the boy.
And later on, Butch Geis and Kelly Jones, which is cool. The title really breathes after the first couple of years when they aren't beholden to showcasing the toys and being stuck having to show their relativity, size relativity stuff. But in the meantime, before, you know, even under those constraints, there's some fun issues ahead between, you know, crossing paths with other denizens of the Marvel Universe, like the Fantastic Four, Ant-Man. Right? It had to be, right?
Yeah. I mean, you'd be a fool not to.
Nightcrawler.
I'm reminded of Larry Hama, who, because the G.I. Joe toy line lasted so much longer, he kept having to introduce, like, when they would come out with new characters or toys or whatever, he'd have to roll out, like, it's the new troop showing up, you know.
For sure. The title evolves into really exploring the cosmology and history of the dynamics in the microverse when they start the backup feature, I think maybe around issue 18 or 19 or so, the Tales of the Microverse. So then you get the lead and the backup, and I just think that all that, in this case, universe building is just really fun stuff because it was done obviously with a lot of love, and I think it's really the best work of Mantlo's career.
Yeah, when I tried an issue or two, IDW rebooted when they had the
Yeah, no.
Hasbro license for a minute, but it didn't work. But
Because they
it might
couldn't.
end up in the Hasbro verse with Mask and ROM and
No,
Transformers and
they
all that
can't use the
stuff.
Marvel properties. They can't use Bug, they can't use Marionette, they can't use Arcturus Ran, although they can use the
Force
space
Commander,
glider. No,
yeah.
the space glider character that he was built off of. But they can't, and that's why Marvel has been able to use Bug and Marionette and Commander Ran, like we saw them in Peter David's Captain Marvel book, right? And in a couple other things. So in various series over the years, because people look upon these characters fondly. They were around for, between the two series and the two annuals, they were around for 75 issues. That's a
Yeah.
solid chunk of Bronze Age goodness.
Oh, for sure. I'm excited to, like I said, I hadn't read these in forever, so it was fun. I'm not sure I read all of them before either. You know, as you say, back then it was sometimes catch as catch can with a lot of getting stuff off the newsstand and whatever. Sometimes you wouldn't find the issue.
Well, I do love reading old comics with you, Andrew, so this will be fun to continue doing.
Yeah, we got. I bought all them Epic editions, even though I have a
I've
bunch
got
of the floppies.
Omnibus. All right, let's make that an issue episode of Marvel Noise. Until
Yeah.
next time, may your Micronauts never melt. Later.